walls by the battle that had taken place. The blood of cultists and the converted stained the ground, their dead bodies scattered amongst the broken remains of constructs. The monster blood that had drenched the place had all evaporated into rainbow smoke. Buildings made with stone-shaping powers had been broken and shattered, crates of supplies left ruined and spoiled. After the death of the Silver Rankers, the Adventure Society stepped in, taking over from Emir's people and heavily securing both sides of the portal arch. Emir wasn't boxed out, still free to explore the astral space, but the Adventure Society's action helped stabilize things after the loss of the Silver Rankers. Ever since the disastrous expedition into the desert astral space, the families of Greenstone had been very wary of losses. After being cleared out, the cultist camp had been repurposed as a base of operations for a thorough exploration of the astral space. The lowest floors of the tower had space for occupation, and Clive was sitting in a room he had claimed, books splayed out on tables as he moved from one to the other, scribbling notes in a book. Clive was kept busy organizing the materials being salvaged that had belonged to the Builder's Ritualists. All the supplies, books, notes, and tools that were found were piled up around him. The camp around the tower had been largely trashed, but the original walled fortress where the cultists first arrived was more intact. A lot of the ritualists' paraphernalia discovered there remained undamaged, and Clive was working to better understand the magic the Builder cult used. If he could better understand the process of turning someone into a vessel, he might be able to find useful information for hunting the energy vampire. The books Knowledge gave to Jason, along with all the notes Clive had taken on them, would have been excellent supplemental material, but they were lost along with Jason. More important to Clive than the vampire was something he was desperately looking for in the cultist's material, but found not so much as a clue to. Engrossed in his work, he didn't notice a beautiful young woman in the robes of a knowledge priestess appear at the open door.
"You won't find it," Gabrielle told Clive, who looked up at the intrusion.
"Acolyte Pellin," he said.
His hair was unruly, his face covered in stubble. There were thick bags under his eyes.
"You need to sleep, Mr. Standish."
Clive narrowed his eyes at the priestess.
"You said I wouldn't find it."
"Yes."
"Then you know what I'm looking for."
"Yes."
"Then tell me."
"I can tell you a part," she said, offering a sad smile that mixed sympathy and apology. "There is only so much my lady will allow me to say."
"Then say it,"
Clive said, too tired for niceties.
"What was that heat coming out of Jason? Did the Builder do something to his soul?"
"My lady does not wish to tell you what that fire is. She will allow me to say that it was not the Builder's doing. Jason Asano's soul was vouchsafed upon his death and sent on its way. The Builder cannot touch it."
"Your goddess is certain. We inquired with the goddess of death, and she didn't know. This place does not fall under the eyes of our gods."
"My goddess is certain," Gabrielle said. "Asano's soul is exactly where it is meant to be."
Clive deflated like a balloon, letting out a long, slow breath. He said nothing for a long time as Gabrielle waited patiently.
"Thank you,"
he said, finally.
"And thank your goddess. It's been preying on all of our minds."
"Normally she would not speak on it," Gabrielle said. "The fate of the dead is not the business of the living. Under the circumstances, she felt it was best to alleviate your concerns."
Clive pushed himself wearily up from the wooden stool where he was sitting and onto his feet.
"I need to go tell the others," he said.
"I have something for you first," Gabrielle said. "You have fought the Builder, and you will again."
"You're damn right."
Gabrielle slid a satchel off of her shoulder and rested it on the desk.
"This dimensional bag has copies of all the books my lady gave to Jason and all the notes you took while studying them. She wants you to have them for the fights to come."
Clive looked at the satchel, then picked it up and slung it over his own shoulder.
"Thank you,"
he said.
"And again, thank your goddess for me."
He hurried past her and out of the room. Gabrielle exited the astral space through the portal arch, arriving back in her own world. Since the deaths at the hands of the energy vampire, the security around the portal arch was much tighter. Anti-portal barriers had been set up, inhibiting teleportation into or out of the underwater dome. Visitors were required to physically return to the lake surface before they could teleport away or travel overland back to the city. Gabrielle stepped onto one of the bubble platforms that had been set up to deliver people to and from the surface. It moved out of the dome, maintaining a bubble of air as it ascended through the water.
"It's done," she said.
"I know."
Knowledge's comforting voice spoke directly into her mind.
"You've done well, but you are uncertain that this is the right approach. Why not tell them?"
"Because this is not a time for comfort," Knowledge said.
"This is a time for war. Asano's death will drive his friends to be more dedicated weapons against the Builder.
I think they would have been motivated even without wanting to avenge him.
But now they are not just motivated. They are zealous. In any case, Asano may never return."
"But you think he will?" Gabrielle said.
"Yes.
If he does, I don't think he'll be happy that you let his friends think he was still dead."
"If he returns, he will have greater concerns than that. His friends are more effective weapons, believing he is dead and gone. It is objectively better for them to think that."
"I can't help wondering if this is one of the times that people aren't going to react the way you think they will,"
Gabrielle said reluctantly.
"I don't think objective results are what Asano is going to value."
Humphrey and Sophie rose up through Emir's cloud palace on the elevating platform, arriving in his private study. It was on top of one of the palace towers, under a shimmering dome of translucent mist. The floor was riddled with water pools from which lush green plants were growing. There were more than the last time Humphrey visited the space. It had become more of a rooftop garden than a study. Emir was behind a desk, glancing up from the papers he was reading. When he saw his guests, he waved in front of him. A pair of cloud chairs rose up from the floor. Humphrey and Sophie moved to sit as Emir put his papers into a folder, then looked up with a smile.
"How are you both doing?"
he asked gently.
"Jason's memorial is done," Humphrey said. "We're ready to take the fight back to the Builder."
"Right back," Sophie agreed. "We're ready to taste cultist blood."
"Easier said than done," Emir said. "The Adventure Society is confident now that the cult activity in this region is finished. They put everything they had into claiming the last astral space, the Church of Purity as well."
"We don't mind traveling to find them," Humphrey said.
"It hasn't reached the point of open fighting," Emir said. "The cult is still being clandestine in their activities, sneaking into astral spaces. Only when we catch them at it does it turn to fighting, but at least we're more prepared than the expedition here."
"Maybe we should go after the Church of Purity," Sophie said.
"The Church of Purity maintains that only a rogue faction is responsible for collaboration, and that they are rooting them out themselves."
"That's crap," Sophie said.
"I agree, and we're not alone," Emir said. "It's a delicate issue, though, for the moment. It's best to let the other churches pressure and investigate them."
"You have something you want us to do," Humphrey said.
"We're not looking to be kept busy. We want to make a difference."
"What I have in mind isn't busy work," Emir said. "The world still has problems that won't stop and wait for us to handle the Builder."
"What do you have in mind?" Humphrey asked.
"Things carried on during your time in the astral space. The monster surge still hasn't happened. We've been getting precursor signs for most of a year now, but it still hasn't happened."
"So I've heard," Humphrey said.
"A number of my family's bronze rankers have crossed into silver from fighting the regular stream of silver rank monsters."
"There have been other developments as well," Emir said. "Did Jason ever tell you about what he learned when he claimed the Reaper's Scythe?"
"All he told me," Humphrey said, was that there was some kind of club, and the first rule was not talking about it. I'm pretty sure he was doing that thing where, well, you know the thing. Emir and Sophie both nodded.
What he learned, Emir said, and the thing he was told not to tell, was that the Order of the Reaper were not, as previously believed, wiped out.
That's not much of a revelation, Humphrey said. I think everyone suspected that.
But only those who became certain of it were granted access to the final room of the test to have their thoughts confirmed. They each received various prizes that came with the confirmation. The scythe, in Jason's case, and an admonition to tell no one.
That's stupid, Sophie said. Why bother to confirm it, then turn around and tell them to keep their mouths shut? There's no way that doesn't leak.
But what if that was the point? Emir asked. One of the few who made it to that last room died, and had her entire contingent wiped out along with her. It happened right in the middle of the lakeside camp, without anyone around them noticing. Later investigation discovered that she was the one who leaked the secret.
If the secret was already out there, why kill them? Humphrey asked. That just brings more attention to it.
Again, Emir said, what if that is the point? In the time you've been away, there have been signs cropping up all over the world that the Order of Reaper is ready to reclaim their old position as a semi-hidden force in the global order. The events here seem to be part of a much larger campaign to make the Order's return an open secret.
Does that mean that the person who hired you to open the astral space is a part of the Order? Sophie asked.
That was my suspicion as well, Emir said. I have since been convinced otherwise. My client, it seems, was used as a tool by the Order. Any guesses on how a diamond ranker feels about being someone else's tool?
Ready to kill some people? Sophie asked.
Ready to kill some people, Emir confirmed. I'm washing my hands of the astral space as the Adventure Society moves in to explore it. They've brought in more high rankers, given the locals are of limited value. My client has asked me to continue the investigation of the Order of the Reaper, and I would like your team to help me.
Not interested, Sophie said. If some old order of assassins wants to run around playing politics, I'm happy to let them. It's the builder that I want.
All the builder's known areas of operation have a higher level of magic than here, Emir warned. That means higher-ranked adventurers, which means that if you go there, you'll be told to shut up and do what you're told. Given that Jason Asano had such a large hand in your training, I don't imagine those are skills you picked up.
So I should just give it up? Sophie asked, combatively.
No, Emir said. I suggest you take a longer view. I doubt the Order of the Reaper is making their appearance now by accident. It seems likely that they are going to try and leverage action against the Builder, to re-establish themselves in the eyes of the world's various authorities.
You're saying that if we go after the Reaper's order, we're likely to stumble into the Builder's cult, Humphrey said.
Honestly, that is just postulation on my part, Emir said. I think the chances are good, though.
Why us? Humphrey asked. Aside from the personal connection, what do we have to offer you, when you have no shortage of silver rankers, let alone bronze?
To be frank, I don't need you, Humphrey,
Emir said, then turned to look directly at Sophie.
I need you, Sophie. Most of what we've managed to learn about the Order of the Reaper, we're fairly certain that the Order itself has put in our path. You, Sophie, are the strongest lead we have on the contemporary activities of the Order of the Reaper that I'm fairly confident didn't come from the Order itself.
You're talking about the fighting style my father taught me, Sophie said.
Yes, Emir said. I want to explore your past and see what we find.
I'd rather just go right after the Builder, she said. The Builder is going to pay for Jason.
I understand your feelings, Emir said. As I said, there are only so many opportunities to go after the Builder directly. Even if you do agree to help me, I think you'll get your chance anyway, courtesy of Clive.
In the astral space tower, Clive was at work combining what had been left by the cultists with what Gabrielle had delivered.
Mr. Standish?
Clive turned to see a man and a woman in the doorway. They were wearing Magic Society robes and both radiated silver rank auras.
You've come for the cultist material?
Clive asked.
We have, the woman said. We've also come for you.
For me? Clive asked. I'm not a Magic Society official anymore. I'm just a regular member. I've gone full-time adventurer.
We are aware, the woman said. Let me introduce myself. My name is Lorelei Grantham, and I'm a researcher assigned to work with the Adventure Society's Continental Council. As we've been collating information about the Builder cult's activities, we realised that a small provincial city was making discoveries about the cult just as quickly as the major centres. When we looked into it, we discovered that you were crucial in many of these discoveries, but had already entered this astral space to take the fight to the Builder.
I'm an adventurer, Clive said. We fight the bad guys. That's an odd turn of phrase, the man said. I had a friend who was prone to odd turns of phrase, Clive said. He died stopping the Builder from using this astral space as a weapon.
Clive gestured at the materials stacked up around him.
I'm still putting it together, he said. But I'm certain that if the Builder's World engineers had been activated and used to invade, the destructiveness of their arrival would have dwarfed the results of simply claiming an astral space. The destruction may well have reached Greenstone, which is hundreds of kilometres away.
Do you know how long the portal will remain stable?
Lorelei asked.
The portals around the edge of the city didn't activate, Clive said. I thought they would, but I was very much improvising, so I was bound to get things wrong. The portal arch we transplanted to this tower will probably hold up for another few weeks before becoming unstable and collapsing. I think the Adventure Society intends to use it as a place to help people rank up until then.
That's my understanding, yes, Lorelei said. Mr. Standish, I've been looking at your record with the Magic Society. You've been wasted here. I'd like you to come work for me at the Continental Council. If you want to revenge your friend, that will put you at the forefront of resisting the Builder's efforts.
I have a team, Clive said. I'm not going to leave them to go off and do research.
We anticipate there will be a goodly amount of fieldwork involved, Lorelei said. That is one of the many reasons that make you so appealing. Your skill set and your team will be ideally suited to acting against the cult directly, as needed. Mr. Amir Bahadir has a use for your team, but we have made arrangements to portal them in should you have a need to go into the field.
Is it true that you use combat rituals? The man asked.
Dennis, Lorelei scolded.
It's really rare, Dennis said.
Clive's left hand flashed, drawing out a simple diagram in the air. He drew the wand strapped to his hip and jammed it into the diagram, which lit up brightly as it affixed itself to the tip. Clive fired the wand at the pair, which showered them in harmless rainbow sparks. The whole process happened in the time it took to draw a breath.
Yes, Clive said. I use combat rituals.
Epilogue Chapter 4. Ducking Responsibility. Arabelle and Amir talked as they made their way through the Cloud Palace.
Are you sure about this?
Amir asked.
I like Sophie, but she's a damaged girl, in more ways than one. I'm not sure that she's in a state right now where I want to entrust my granddaughter to her.
This is a good match, Arabelle said. Sophie lived a life where she couldn't trust anyone but Belinda. A complete stranger came along and transformed her life, only to be snatched away as she was coming to terms with that. What she needs now is a place to channel everything that isn't self-destructive. Being responsible for someone else, the way Jason took responsibility for her, is exactly what she needs.
That's fine, but what about the things my granddaughter needs?
Kettis is at a tricky stage right now, Arabelle said. She got her essences so young, so she's been waiting longer than most to get out into the world. She's full of rebellious ideas.
That much I know,
Emir said, a long-suffering expression on his face.
Sophie isn't like the authority figures your granddaughter knows. Kettis is used to pushing around people who won't stand their ground for the simple reason that she's your granddaughter. They know how soft you are with her and are afraid to be harder. Sophie is not. She'll provide the boundaries and life experience that Kettis needs right now.
They entered one of the lounges to find Sophie drinking Emir's expensive alcohol straight from the bottle.
She's also the kind of person a rebellious young girl can look up to, Arabelle said.
Sophie nodded a greeting without putting down the bottle, from which she continued to quaff. She finally lowered the half-empty bottle, replacing the stopper as she looked over the bar.
Where did this one come from again?
She muttered to herself.
You can go ahead and take it, Emir said.
Nice,
Sophie said, slipping it into the dimensional pouch on her hip.
So, what did you want to see me for?
Well, as you know better than most, Arabelle said, the experiences we have at Iron Rank are important in shaping the adventurers we become.
Is that why you turned out the way you are? Sophie asked Emir. You said something about a giant metal duck, right?
You told her that was at Iron Rank?
Arabelle asked Emir.
Probably, Emir said. It was probably what she needed to hear at the time.
You should never take what Emir tells you at face value,
Arabelle warned Sophie.
I know the type,
Sophie answered with a sad smile.
So he wasn't Iron Rank?
No, Arabelle said. In fact, it was the very last job our team did together, about 8 years ago.
Emir crawled out of the mud hole, Gabriel and Arabelle crawling out after him. They found Cal waiting for them, as neat and clean as they were filthy.
How do you always do that?
Emir asked.
That's nothing, Cal said. I've been in the real mud.
What does that even mean? Emir complained.
There's little point in explaining, Cal said. You're giving up the adventuring life. There's brown sludge packed into my underwear, like I ate a bunch of clay and then soiled myself, Emir complained. I'm gold rank. I haven't used a toilet in 30 years. If this is the adventuring life, I'll be glad to see the back of it.
The team made its way back to the Cloud House, where the three mud-caked adventurers spent an hour in the shower. They vociferously expressed their gratitude at finding an array of food waiting, courtesy of Cal.
So, how's it going? Collecting the materials to upgrade the cloud flask?
Gabriel asked.
The last of them should be waiting for me when we get back to Vitesse, Emir said. Once I can turn this place into a nice big ship, then my storied career as a professional treasure hunter will begin.
I can't believe anyone would hire you to find anything, Cal said, unless it's hidden in a brothel.
You didn't hear, Cal, Arabelle said. Our sweet boy Emir has mended his sexually adventurous ways.
I don't believe it, Cal said.
This is what you miss when you pick up extra contracts instead of taking a break with the rest of us, Gabriel said.
You don't get to Diamond Rank by taking breaks, Cal said.
That's true enough, Arabelle said. He really does seem to have come around, though. He's met someone.
Man, woman, or fish?
Cal asked.
Merfolk are not fish, Emir said. They happen to be very sensual people.
Very sensual fish people, Cal muttered.
It's a capable young Bronze Rank girl, Arabelle said. I quite like her.
Bronze rank, Cal muttered. Cradle snatching.
In all seriousness, you be careful, Gabriel told Emir. Cal's not wrong that she's young. Between the rank difference and the fact that she's going to be working for you, there's a lot of ways you could take advantage. Don't let me hear that you did.
What kind of sleaze do you take me for?
Emir asked, only to be met by three flat expressions.
Oh, nice.
If you like this girl, be patient, Arabelle said. She's not a match for you right now. If she's working for you, she's not going anywhere. Give her time to come into her own.
How much time? I don't want to be going around a decade from now, still mooning over her. She'll definitely have someone else by then,
Cal goaded.
That's fine, Emiya said. Highly suspicious accidents happen every day.
No, Arabelle scolded. Bad Emiya.
I'm not a naughty puppy, Emiya said.
You kind of are, though, Gabriel said,
the other two nodding their agreement.
See, this is why I'm retiring, Emiya said. If all the people I'm working with are getting paid by me, they have to show me some respect.
He looked to Gabriel and Arabelle.
I know Cal won't stop taking contracts, but what about you two? Will you callously replace me and get right back to adventuring?
Rufus is old enough to start training properly now, Arabelle said. We're going to step away from contracts for a while and be home for the next monster surge. We'll be taking a more hands-on approach instead of just leaving everything to the academy.
I wouldn't go expecting him to get his essences too soon, Gabriel warned. All the boys in my family are later bloomers.
The team returned to the village the mud monster had been threatening, only to find it disturbingly devoid of people. In their place, they found piles of mud throughout the village, which had the clothes of the villagers inside them.
What in the world happened?
Gabriel asked, crouched next to a pile of mud in the mayor's house. He fished out a necklace he remembered seeing around the mayor's neck.
Did they all turn into mud?
Cal turned, looking through the wall.
There's someone here. He's skilled. I can barely sense his aura.
The team went out onto the street. The man there was wearing sandy-colored leathers with numerous tribal markings sewed in. They were designed to blend in with the tattoos on his skin. He was an elf with stark white hair, reddish skin, and golden eyes.
Greetings, the elf said. Did you kill the mud lord that was inhabiting this region?
If you mean the awful mud monster in a hole in the woods, then yes, Emiya said.
I have been pursuing its progenitor, the man said. An emperor ooze.
Are you from the Walsh tribe?
Cal asked.
You recognize our markings, the elf said. I am Brian, son of Kevin.
As in Kevin, son of Jeremy, son of Dennis?
Cal asked.
That is my father, yes, Brian said.
You come from a strong line, Cal praised.
I am proud to trace my lineage all the way back to Jeff, Lord of the Hunt, Brian said.
The team introduced themselves.
I have heard there are more name, Brian said. It is said that you raise fine warriors.
Do you know what happened to the villagers here?
Arabelle asked.
There were never villagers here, the man said. They were homunculi of the Mudlord.
Then why would they send for the Adventure Society to come kill it?
Gabriel asked.
Only the truly capable can defeat a Mudlord in their lair, Brian said. They like to call the strong to fight them, then consume them to grow stronger. It seems that you were more than it could handle, however. You have my respect.
I'd rather have your soap, Emiya said. You don't have any crystal wash, do you?
Again with this, Gabriel asked.
It was your job to stock up the potions, Emiya said. I very specifically reminded you that we were low on crystal wash.
You have a magical cloud house with crystal wash in the shower water.
Diluted crystal wash. It isn't the same.
Arabelle gave Brian an apologetic smile, while Cal ran a frustrated hand over his face.
So this isn't a real village?
Arabelle asked.
I told you it was weird that all the buildings were new, Cal said.
I intended to recruit aid before challenging the Emperor Ooze that produced the Mudlord you fought. You have proven yourself capable, and I would be honored if you would join me in my quest.
Actually, we were just about to head back to...
Ow!
Emiya was cut off by Cal stamping on his foot.
Are there magic spikes on the bottom of your boots?
Emiya asked.
The honor would be ours, Cal said to Brian, ignoring Emiya. To fight alongside a warrior of the Walsh tribe is a privilege.
We'd be happy to help, Arabelle agreed.
As Gabriel's attacks threatened the Emperor Ooze's core, the Ooze minions melted back into puddle shapes and rapidly flowed in the core's direction. They formed a thin, gelatinous barrier around it that reformed with every attack.
"Get ready," Brian called out. "I'll expose the core to let you finish it off."
No longer under attack after the sudden retreat of the Oozlings, Brian took the opportunity to pour powdered iron onto the ground in a circle. He quickly finished the summoning, and an enormous iron duck rose from the circle, earning a skeptical eyebrow raise from Emir.
"That thing looks ridiculous."
The iron duck let out a sound that was a quack by way of an earthquake, the air shimmering as noise blasted out in a tsunami of force. The continuous barrage of sound struck like a fire hose, streaming full bore into a jelly dessert, splattering ooze everywhere. As the cacophonous blast finally subsided, a V formation of iron mallards swooped into the hole that had been burrowed in the Emperor Ooze's protective sheath. They each let out smaller sonic attacks of their own before exploding into metal fragments, the accumulated damage once more revealing the Emperor Ooze's core. Gabriel and Emir didn't waste any time, dashing forward into the hole in the monster that was already starting to close. They destroyed the core, and the ooze lost all cohesion, rapidly liquefying. Inundated in the dissolution of the ooze, Gabriel and Emir were washed up at the feet of their companions like bedraggled sailors from a shipwreck. Emir got to his feet, looking at himself with disgust as he shook his arms to fling off goo.
"Tell me again about how it doesn't matter that you forgot to get more crystal wash," he asked loudly, ears still ringing from the thunderous quack.
Gabriel tried to get to his feet, slipped on ooze, and fell over again.
"I think I may have to acknowledge the point," he conceded, lying in the stinking residue.
Brian ignored the mess to wade in and help Gabriel to his feet.
"You add a credit to your name," Brian said. "You fight well."
"Thanks," Gabriel said. "You too."
"Okay, this time I'm really done with having adventures," Emir said.
"You are giving up the path of the warrior?" Brian asked.
"Damn right," Emir said. "I'm going to be a treasure hunter, professionally, for money, plus treasure."
"Uncovering hidden secrets, unraveling ancient mysteries, and exploring unseen horizons," Brian said. "An admirable way to spend a life."
"Nice," Emir said, pleasantly surprised. "This lot thinks I'm a quitter."
"Warriors claim the glory," Brian said. "But who builds the homes they live in? Sing the songs of their deeds? Each of us must find our own path and contributes in our own way."
"You know, I like you, Brian," Emir said. "Have you ever considered treasure hunting in a subordinate capacity?"
Rufus led Kettus into the lounge as Emir was wrapping up his story.
"Emir was just telling Sophie about how he met Brian," Arabelle told her son, whose face took on a grimacing smile. "He told her they met while he was Iron Rank, but you were Iron Rank when you met Brian's son, right?"
"Yes," Rufus said, flatly. "Yes, I was."
"Why don't you tell us about it?" Arabelle asked sweetly.
"Mother!"
"Son?"
Rufus sighed. Although Roland Ramore was rarely spotted on the Ramore Academy campus, the presence of the Diamond Rank Arch-Chancellor was always felt. When he did make an appearance, it drew all eyes. Whenever he acted personally, the ramifications were much discussed. Most recently, he was rumored to have personally brought in some boy from the remote countryside to join the academy. Roland Ramore looked like a well-preserved 40, a tenth of the reality. He was tall, strong, and handsome, with a round bush of dark, curly hair and a neatly trimmed goatee. Walking behind him was a boy of 15, wearing plain leather hide and sandals. Rufus Ramore was the Prince of Ramore Academy, the talented heir apparent to the power and prestige of his family legacy. He was lounging in the dueling courtyard with his friends, watching the friendly matches. He didn't bother to participate, as there was no one there who posed a challenge. He wasn't going to go punching down. Everything stopped the moment the Arch-Chancellor appeared, no one paying attention to the boy moving in his wake. Rufus immediately leapt to his feet, rushing to respectfully greet his grandfather, although he would not address him as such on campus. "Arch-Chancellor," Rufus greeted, bowing his head.
"Just who I was looking for," Roland said. "Rufus, I've brought in a young man to join the academy."
Rufus looked at the boy for the first time. He was a white-haired elf, packing more muscle than most of his race. He could sense the boy's aura, in the early stages of iron rank, but well-controlled. Rufus felt a familiar pang of jealousy at the boy's youth, having had to wait until he was 19 before his body was ready to accept essences.
"I thought," Roland continued, "that there would be no better way to introduce him than a friendly spar with our finest student."
A susurrus went through the crowd of students looking on. The Arch-Chancellor personally bringing a stranger to fight Rufus Remore was the kind of event everyone not present would be sore over missing. Soon, illusionary doubles of Rufus and the boy were in one of the courtyard's arenas, their bodies inert on nearby projecting platforms.
"I exhort you all to watch closely," Roland announced to the gathered students, as if there was even a single one whose eyes were not glued to the spectacle. "I believe that this will be an important lesson for all." "I am Rufus Remore," Rufus said formally as he conjured a golden sword.
"I am Kenneth, son of Brian," the boy said, calling out his summoned familiar.
It was a duck. Epilogue Chapter 5 Show and Tell. D.S. Adam Cosgrove was 31 years old and looked like a detective from a TV show. He wasn't good-looking enough for it to be an American show, but he had a disheveled intelligence that was compelling enough for a middlingly successful British or Australian crime drama. He was in the middle of an apartment building, standing next to a uniformed officer. An older woman, this officer had the air of having seen it all. In her case, that meant all the horrible things people do to one another.
"Have you ever seen anything like this?" Adam asked.
"Nope. I've seen some weird business, but this is a new one on me."
The apartment building was ordinarily an unremarkable one, on the upper end of lower class. Melbourne, like most cities, had more than enough of them to go around. This particular one, however, had developed an unusual feature. Despite the exterior wall remaining intact, a large chunk of the interior was missing. It hadn't been destroyed in an explosion or collapsed in some kind of structural disaster. There was no debris or collateral damage. It was just gone. An empty space inside a building where an entire apartment should have been. The exterior wall was intact, but the rest of the apartment was gone. Along with portions of the apartments around, above, and below it. What truly made the space remarkable was that it took the form of a perfect sphere. It was as if someone had lifted off the top half of the building and taken out a scoop before putting the top back on. Walls, floor, carpet, and furniture were cut with the smooth precision of a laser. Pipes now just ended, requiring the building's plumbing to be shut down due to spillage.
"It mostly affected the one apartment?" Adam asked.
"Yep,"
the officer said, looking at the clipboard notes she was holding.
"It touched on the surrounding apartments, but centered on this one. The guy above got banged up pretty bad when the floor under his bed vanished, and he dropped two apartments down. It was a lucky thing he didn't land on anyone."
"That's how it was described?" Adam asked. "Just vanishing. No explosion or anything?"
"Some of the neighbours described a sucking air noise, like in movies, when someone shoots an airplane window and the air goes rushing out."
"What about whoever lived in the apartment? Has anyone else been significantly hurt?"
"Just the one man who dropped two floors was hurt badly. There were some minor injuries amongst the other occupants, but not many. We've been tracking down residents, making sure they're either here or otherwise accounted for.
The only one we couldn't find was the sole resident of the apartment that had occupied the centre of the missing space.
It happened in the middle of the night, Adam said. The poor sod is probably in the same place as the rest of his apartment. Do we have a name?
Yeah, it's... She checked her clipboard again. Jason Asano.
Are you serious? Adam asked.
Detective Sergeant, this matter is not a concern for the Victoria Police. It's a federal issue.
It's an apartment building where you claim there was a simple accident. How is that a federal crime?
It will go better for everyone if you don't go around asking questions like that, Detective Sergeant.
The apartment building had been evacuated of people, ostensibly on the basis of structural instability due to the damage. Now, what looked like a small army of forensics people had claimed a number of the apartments as set-up areas and were crawling over the interior like ants. Adam was in a ground-floor apartment, where the federal police had set up a command post. Their goal seemed to be to create as small a visible footprint as possible, although they were having little success. The displaced residents and rumours spreading were made all the worse by the media, which had already been present. The military had been conducting one of its unannounced terrorism readiness exercises nearby through the night, part of a new program that was starting to draw press attention. The local police had been directly and explicitly instructed to completely remove themselves, outside of the uniformed officers being used to secure the exterior of the building. Adam might have left it at that, if the explanation he was given wasn't so patently absurd.
You're seriously going... with a gas explosion? He asked. A gas explosion in a building with no gas service, blowing a perfectly spherical hole with no debris and a blast area that completely annihilated everything up to a point and then completely stopping dead. An explosion that no one heard despite being in a building full of people.
Detective Sergeant, we have already asked you nicely to leave this matter be. We highly recommend that you move on and do not give this incident any further thought. Otherwise, we will have to move on from asking, the ramifications of which will fall directly on you and be unambiguously negative.
Adam glared at the woman. The federal police officer had a nicer suit and nicer hair than him. She was not a large woman, but her stern features and short-cropped hair radiated professionalism.
Are you threatening me? He asked.
Yes, Detective Sergeant. You need to forget all about this incident, or you will find the weight that drops down on you from a very great height sufficient to squash you and your career like a bug under a shoe.
Adam glowered. In addition to the feds, there were military personnel and some less conventional people busying themselves. There was a group talking quietly amongst themselves, that Adam's trained eye picked out as not being law enforcement or military, in spite of the expensive suits. From the looks of things, however, their presence was wholly unchallenged, unlike his own. He turned to leave.
Detective Sergeant, the federal officer called out.
What? He asked.
I need to know that you won't interfere further.
I'm leaving, aren't I?
You need to tell me that you understand. I want to hear you say it.
And I want you to get run over by a bulldozer, Adam said. We don't get everything we want in life.
Detective Sergeant, I'd better not hear that you've been talking to the media. And if you do, I will hear about it.
He left, not bothering to respond. Someone stopped Erica Asano outside the cafe.
I just bought your new cookbook.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
I was so sorry to hear about your brother.
Thank you.
She took a selfie with the fan before going inside, making her way into a secluded booth in the back. She sat down opposite a man who looked like he had slept in his suit. He smelled like he was several days past his last shower, but only minutes past his last drink. He had bloodshot eyes and a scratchy beard.
Hello, Detective, she said, voice and face both filled with concern. Not anymore,
Adam said. I'm sorry to hear that. I hate to think that I pushed you to...
You didn't push me into anything, he said. I walked into this with my eyes wide open.
What do you have? Erica asked. You didn't sound optimistic over the phone.
Adam took a battered folder from the satchel on the seat next to him, placing it on the table. Then he took a flash drive from his pocket and placed it on top of the folder.
I've taken this as far as it will go, he said. I've been chewing my way around the outside, but there's no way into the middle. It's like there's a giant hole at the center of all this, and nothing that would fit makes any kind of sense.
What are you saying?
Erica asked.
This is as far as it goes, Adam said, patting the folder. This is everything I have. There's some photos in there of the space where your brother's apartment should be. I shouldn't have those, so be careful where you flash them around. Or don't. I don't care.
There's nowhere else to take the investigation?
Erica asked.
I've put together enough of the puzzle to see there's one very big, very weird piece missing. There's a secret here, and I promise you that neither you nor I will be able to crack it. I know it's somehow connected to all those terrorist readiness drills the military are doing. I know someone is influencing government bodies at an incredibly high level, and I know there is some kind of operation working completely in the dark. I don't know if it's some kind of off-the-books intelligence program or what, but they have a stupid amount of pull.
A waitress came by, and Erica ordered some tea. Adam ordered coffee.
I don't care, as long as it's strong and hot.
So what now?
Erica asked, after the waitress walked away.
Now I go spend my rent money on bourbon. This is the end of the road, Mrs. Asano. There's a secret here, and it's a lot bigger than you and me. The only thing I kept out of this folder is a number of deaths I'm pretty sure happened to keep that secret. I won't let you go poking around and get killed too.
Are you in danger?
She asked. Adam let out a bitter laugh.
Frankly, I'm amazed I'm still alive. I was advised to leave this alone multiple times. Then I was told, then I was fired. Don't make my mistake. I know you don't have answers for what happened to your brother, but you need to find a way to let it go.
You're going to sit there, having thrown everything into this, and tell me to walk away?
She asked.
Mrs. Asano, not everyone who told me to back off had something to hide. They knew what keeping it this would cost me, and they were right. Just look at me. I don't have anyone. You have family. I know he was your brother, but would he want your family to get hurt chasing answers when he's already dead?
Erica's face scrunched with unwillingness, but she gave a slight nod.
I don't like this, she said.
The people behind this don't want you to like it, Adam said. They want you to shut up and stop poking into this, or they'll kill you.
Are you seriously suggesting I would be murdered by some conspiracy group? That's absurd.
Mrs. Asano, those deaths I mentioned, there weren't any murders. There were car accidents, house fires, suicides.
Which could be exactly what they seem.
Suicide will be how they do you, by the way. Celebrity chef kills herself after brother's tragic death in gas explosion. Friends say she became erratic in the months following her brother's death, obsessed with conspiracy theories. She was known to associate with disgraced former detective.
The return of the waitress with their drinks forestalled Erica's response.
Do you really expect me to believe any of this?
She asked, once the waitress was gone again.
I barely believe it, Adam said, with a wry, weary smile. But remember, you were the one who found me. We both know this thing has stunk from the word go. But don't make my mistakes. You have people that can still get hurt.
He placed a hand on the folder.
This is almost everything I've been able to put together, from copies of police reports to my personal notes. You can take it. But I'm asking you not to. Go home and look after your family.
Detective, Mr. Cosgrove. I did come to you. I can't help but feel I am in part responsible for the circumstance you find yourself in.
I may have bought a first-class ticket for the self-pity train, Mrs. Asano, but I know who put me where I am, and it wasn't you.
She looked at the folder under his hand for a long time, before standing up without touching it. I'll take your advice, Mr. Cosgrove. I know we probably won't meet again, but do not hesitate to contact me if you ever need something. I appreciate how much you've sacrificed looking for the truth about my brother.
It was never about you or your brother for me, Mrs. Asano.
I appreciate it, nonetheless.
She took out some money, leaving it next to her untouched tea.
For the drinks.
Adam shuffled wearily through the bottle shop. Standing in front of the bourbon was a woman dressed in an exquisite suit. She was looking right at him.
His memory stirred.
You're one of them, he said. You were there, when Asano's apartment went wherever the hell it went.
I was there, yes. Although we never actually met. You have a good eye, and a sharp memory, Mr. Cosgrove. It's what makes you a good investigator.
Adam snorted.
Being a good investigator is about legwork and persistence, he said. You can shove that Sherlock Holmes crap up your ass.
He moved forward to take a bottle, and she stepped into his path.
Lady, if you think I won't kick your ass right here, then you're underestimating how little I've got to lose anymore.
Adam drew a sharp breath as the woman's presence seemed to strangely swell until it felt like she was towering over him, despite not having moved. He suddenly felt incredibly vulnerable and exposed, with no idea why. He fought back against the feeling by calling on the wellspring of anger that had been simmering inside of him for months, grabbing the front of the woman's suit with both hands. Her own hands gripped his forearms like a pair of industrial clamps, pulling his hands off of her with a mechanical inexorability.
Jesus, lady, are you a friggin' Terminator?
Mr. Cosgrove, I'm here to offer you the thing you have been chasing since this all began. The things that destroyed your life. The secret you've been circling without ever being able to see.
Are you kidding me?
We've been watching your efforts, Mr. Cosgrove. You are a dogged and determined investigator who looks beyond the obvious and is unflinching when others lack resolve.
And hasn't that worked out well for me?
Mr. Cosgrove, come work for us. All the answers you've been looking for are just the beginning of what you'll receive.
You want me to work for you? He asked, incredulous. Everything you've done, and you want me to throw in with you?
Mr. Cosgrove, your life is not in a good position right now.
Because of you, you wretched harpy.
We can make amends and more.
And if I tell you to shove it up your ass?
Then you can drink yourself to death in ignorance, she said. You don't have the credibility to cause us any problems. Convincing Erica Asano to let it go was a smart move. You were wrong, though. It wouldn't have been suicide.
Adam's hand flashed out, snatching a bottle from the shelf and swinging it at her head. Her reflexes were too fast for him to follow, and the next thing he knew, he was stumbling back and falling over, the bottle in her hand.
That's disappointing,
she said, as she put the bottle back on the shelf.
I think you could have been quite remarkable, Mr. Cosgrove.
She walked away as Adam pulled himself to his feet. She turned the corner, and he didn't see her again. Adam walked out of the bottle shop with a half dozen bottles in a cardboard box. He glanced around the parking lot, habitually taking in the details. There was a man who had been sitting in a car before Adam arrived, who now got out and started walking in his direction.
She's a bitch, isn't she?
The man called out. He was wearing a pastel shirt with the top two buttons undone and a white jacket over white slacks. He was white, looked around Adam's age, and had an American accent.
Excuse me? Adam asked. Miranda, the man said. She probably didn't tell you her name, though, did she? Look, Miami Vice, Adam said. I've had my fill of mysterious pricks, so how about you sod off?
Yeah, I get why you're bitter. Can I call you Adam?
You can bugger off.
Adam resumed the walk to his car.
She's not the only one who can tell you the big secret, you know,
the man called after him. Adam stopped and turned around.
Save it, mate. I'm not buying.
The man chuckled. I'm Dash, he said. And yeah, I'd like to recruit you as well. Say what you want about Miranda, but she knows good material when she sees it.
I told her to stick it up her ass, Adam said. You can stick it up her ass too.
Dash laughed again.
You know, I like you, Adam. Here's the difference between me and Miranda. She'll let you in on the big secret if you agree to join her little group and follow orders like a good boy. Me, though, I'm going to tell you the secret. Right here, right now. If you want to throw in with us after, then great. If not, then all it cost me was a little time.
You're okay with me knowing, then just going my own way.
My organization isn't like Miranda's. We don't care about keeping the secret. The thing is, the secret wants to be told. Every year it gets harder and harder to keep it under wraps, and we have no interest in helping.
Then what do you do?
We're getting ready for the day that the secret isn't a secret anymore.
I'll be happy to tell you all about it, but you're going to want answers first.
What is this great, big, important secret that I'm walking around?
You're going to tell me, just like that.
If I just told you, you wouldn't believe me, Dash said.
I'm going to show you.
Epilogue Chapter 6 Beyond Our Ability to Control. The Adventure Society and the Magic Society had both sent people flooding into the astral space. For the Adventure Society, it was a precious chance to rapidly advance some of their more promising members. It was currently ideal for skilled bronze rankers and even freshly ranked up silvers to advance their abilities. For the Magic Society, it was a chance to get a handle on the advanced astral magic the Builder's Cult had been wielding. For both, it was a chance to prepare for the battle against the Builder's forces still escalating around the world. Once again working for the Magic Society, Clive's first task was to return to the astral space from which he had recently emerged. It would only remain accessible for a limited time, but now the limitations of rank were removed from entry, it was a treasure trove of knowledge and opportunity. It was also a treasure trove of actual treasure, but that was the Adventure Society's area. Clive had not revealed the materials that knowledge had given first to Jason and then to him. He implicitly understood that the goddess had already been pushing boundaries. That said, any of it he could link to what they found in the astral space, he did so immediately. He attributed any suspicious leaps of insight to having studied the Builder's magic during his previous time in the astral space. It wasn't exactly a lie. To the best of his understanding, the information knowledge had given them was taken from the Builder's people. It was also true that Clive had studied materials they had taken from the Builder cult's two campsites. The cult's original arrival site had a building apparently occupied by the cult's ritualists and containing much of the material handed over by knowledge. That freed up Clive's ability to share the information and eased his scruples. He abhorred the idea of being credited for magical breakthroughs he did not actually make himself. Atop one of the portal towers at the edge of the city, Clive was explaining some of the magic involved with the portal archers, although the tower archers were still inactive. His audience was a group of Magic Society astral magic scholars who had portaled to Greenstone from far and wide. Information that would help them stop the Builder from seizing more astral spaces was currently the world's most precious commodity. Any doubts the assemblage held about Clive's capabilities as a provincial scholar had been quickly expelled by his expertise. The group were protected from the dangers of the astral space by a contingent of Adventure Society members, led by a silver ranker and including Clive's own team. Although they would each be following different pursuits in the near future, for the moment they followed him into the astral space. Despite the assurances of the Adventure Society that they would all be kept safe, the team would not be dislodged. They were not going to lose another member to that place. Of Clive's team, only Belinda had joined the Magic Society people in listening to Clive's lecture. The rest of the adventurers were placed around the edge of the tower. These were not Greenstone locals, but more capable imports, part of a much larger group brought in for the exploration of the astral space. Only the most elite of Greenstone's own adventurers had even been allowed to participate. This was a small handful of bronze rankers, including Henrietta Geller and Cassandra Mercer, both of whom were edging up on silver rank. Beth Cavendish and her team had reached bronze rank, while Humphrey's team were in the astral space, although they were not as advanced as Humphrey and the others. Months in the pressure cooker of the astral space had allowed them to leapfrog their peers. Humphrey stood right at the edge of the tower, eyes panning from the water stretching out to the horizon and back to the city. Experienced eyes picked out the potential approach points of the familiar buildings of the crumbling brick, struggling under fecund jungle. Next to him was the silver ranker, a man with wild dark hair named Pranesh.
"You don't need to be so vigilant," Pranesh said. "If you don't respect this place, it will kill you," Humphrey said.
"The builder's vessel is gone, and we mopped up what was left of his people," Pranesh said.
"All that's left are monsters."
"This place keeps dangerous secrets," Humphrey said.
"I'm not so foolish as to think we've found them all."
"Don't bother trying to tempt my little brother into slacking off," Henrietta said, walking over to them. "They train all us Gellers, but Humphrey is the measuring stick now. He always embodied the training, but now he's been through the fire. He's exactly the adventurer we're trying to make."
"You're exaggerating, Henry," Humphrey said.
"See? Modesty. Just like good little Geller boy."
Nearby, Sophie glanced back at Belinda, seeing her engrossed in Clive's impromptu lecture. She wandered over to stand next to her friend, giving Belinda a companionable shoulder bump. Belinda flashed her smile before returning her gaze back to Clive.
"You should do it," Sophie said quietly.
Clive had asked Belinda to resume her previous position as his research assistant. Since that meant separating from Sophie, if only temporarily, she had declined the offer.
"You're going to go off with Amir, looking for your family," Belinda said. "A family who, as best anyone can tell, are some kind of ancient order of murderers. How can I leave you alone for that?"
Sophie glanced back at Humphrey and Neil. Humphrey was his usual diligent self. Neil had his legs hanging off the edge of the tower. Cassandra Mercer sitting next to him as they chatted quietly.
"I won't be alone," Sophie said. "It's not just you and me anymore." "You're seeing that there's no way to stabilize the portal and maintain access to the astral space?"
Lorelei asked. She, along with the other Magic Society members, were still struggling to get their heads around the astral magic concepts Clive was explaining.
"Maintaining a stable portal isn't the issue," Clive said,
patting the portal arch he was standing next to.
"This isn't an astral space in the traditional sense. It's a vehicle, a transcendent rank vehicle in the shape of an astral space. A vehicle that is now slowly pulling away from our world, which is beyond our ability to control."
"Why is it pulling away?"
Lorelei asked. Lorelei was a fair-skinned woman with blonde hair. The beautifying effect of her bronze rank hadn't made her as radiant as someone like Sophie, but she still had the healthy, athletic look of a magically idealized body. The effects on the body of ranking up were more pronounced on those who didn't already have the looks and physique of a Humphrey or a Sophie. For them, it was akin to polishing an already stunning gemstone, rather than carving a beautiful sculpture from a mundane rock.
"The builder was taking control of this place," Clive said.
"Only a being of his level could actually do so, but we were lucky. The limits of his vessel meant that he still required an intermediary control. Namely, the tower now standing in the center of the astral space."
All eyes turned as Clive gestured. From their position,